Welcome to AEC Perspectives. I'm your host, Brian Nickel, Chief Strategy Officer for RSNH. And today, I am thrilled to have RSNH's National Sustainability and Resiliency Director, Linnea Brudenell, on the podcast. As a key member of RSNH's Business Growth Strategy Team, Linnea works directly with senior leadership to develop strategies to integrate environmental sustainability and resilience principles across enterprise-wide building and infrastructure activities. Linnea has served as the Director of Sustainability in the private sector since 2015, where she managed sustainability and resiliency consulting for projects worth more than $500 million. As a member of the American Institute of Architects Large Firm Roundtable, RSNH has long been focused on resiliency and sustainability with an eye toward a future-built environment that is carbon neutral. Working with its clients, RSNH has documented savings of more than 2 million megawatt hours of electricity, 1.4 billion pounds of waste, and more than 500 million gallons of water, resulting in millions of tons of avoided greenhouse gas emissions. Today, I'm looking forward to discussing the importance of sustainability and resiliency, differences and similarities between the two, and the rise of efforts around this subject throughout our industry. Linnea, let's dive right in.
Sounds good, Brian.
It's so great to have you here today. So let's start off with a key question, and that is, what is the difference between sustainability and resiliency?
I'm glad you asked, and you're right. That question comes up a lot. Sustainability is development that meets the needs of the present generation without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. And I'll throw in an analogy here from Aesop's Fable, which I had a lot of when I was a kid, the ant and the grasshopper. So the grasshopper in this analogy played his fiddle all summer long, and he never saved any food for the winter. The ants never danced and never sang all summer long. They worked and they stored away food. So in this analogy, the sustainability is, we're the ants. We need to make sure we are providing for our future generations and not exploiting or degenerating our natural resources. So I love this analogy because it's simple. And when I talk to children about it, they all get it, the dancing and the singing of the grasshopper all summer long. Doesn't quite do it for the long winter ahead. So resiliency, or another way of saying resilience, is assurance or adaptation. Is the ability to maintain function and operations when an unexpected hazardous event happens, whether that's a natural disaster or terrorism or a weather event such as earthquake, fire, hurricane, volcanoes, dust storms, extreme heat, everything that we, you know, seem to be facing more and more often here.
Well, that analogy around the ants and the grasshopper is so appropriate as we just entered into the fall season, as we're heading into winter ourselves here in the Northern Hemisphere. And so I appreciate how you frame that. Let's kind of dive in a little bit further into sustainability and resiliency and really talk about what the main priorities of each one are. You hit on those, but could you kind of extrapolate out a little bit the main priorities for each of sustainability and resiliency?
Sure. Sustainability, really, one of the key priorities is to manage our natural resources. That ties in with currently, the move in the green building world is embodied carbon. And the embodied carbon tracking is a way to measure the environmental impact of extraction and manufacturing of a product used in the built environment. And that's a good tool to really understand a material side of things and the preservation of natural resources. Another key component of sustainability is health and wellness. And our building stock, typically it's a 50 to 60 year life cycle of our building stock. So we want to make sure the indoor environment is a healthy environment and promotes wellness for the building occupants, whether they're residents or if they're employees of an organization.
And I think that when you think about sustainability and resiliency, and these are popular terms these days, it's really important to look beyond just the term and understand what it means for our industry. And being in engineering and architecture and consulting, advising clients, where do you see the overlap between sustainability and resiliency? And what do you think that means for our clients who are trying to navigate this area?
So in terms of sustainability and resilience, one key overlap is in the energy sector. When we talk about energy resilience and energy independence, we're also talking about reducing operational carbon and increasing operational efficiency. In other words, we lower our energy use while we provide perhaps renewable resources to meet that need, driving towards a net zero future. So energy resilience may mean for an organization, they go ahead and they buy carbon offsets. It may mean for another organization that they develop a microgrid. Apple is famous for using their own solar PV fields to power their server centers. So they can remain completely off the grid and energy resilient. So we can all go and use our Google and our Apple phones. And in case of a power outage, we always have that data available. We can access our cloud photos. So it's an interesting world. Water resiliency and sustainability is the same premise. Reduce the use as much as possible, be conservative in our resource use. And then on the other side, perhaps regenerate that resource in many different ways.
And so we have one earth, and that one earth provides both, you know, those items that are essential, whether it be water, for example, for us to live by. And so we want to use it efficiently, but we also want to have measures in place where we can reuse in some cases, or use so efficiently that it doesn't have a negative impact in our world. Is that a way to look at this?
Yeah, that's perfect. We strive in this particular realm of the built environment in this industry. We're really striving to reduce the negative consequences of human impact. And architecture and engineering and infrastructure design, really as a whole, everybody's moving towards this idea.
You know, at RSNH, we have this brand notion that we're going to talk about a little bit later called Driven to Care. And it's really about taking that notion of Driven to Care and driving it into the work that we do so that we can not have the negative consequences, so we can strive to reduce that where possible and actually have an end positive situation as it pertains to vital resources, natural resources, our built environment, how we work and play and live every day. Is all of this sort of intertwined as you think about it from a sustainability and resiliency standpoint?
Yes, it is really intertwined. Sustainability, we're really trying to think Horizon 3 in RSNH language, in our strategic growth language. We think Horizon 3, right? We want to provide for that Horizon 3. We want our clients to thrive in Horizon 3. That may be a 5 to 10 year timeline. It might be a 30 year timeline. There's a trend with municipalities now to do a 50 year plan, a 50 year sustainability and resilience plan. Looking ahead, for example, in Arizona, we have extreme heat. We're doing forecasts now 50 to 80 years out about what the ground temperature may be, for instance, at a university. How do we manage that and provide a path forward that's a positive path forward for our next generations?
And so let me switch, if I can, from this worldview, this broader view, the definitional view, and kind of bring that into a vision for RSNH. What is your vision as our national sustainability and resiliency director for sustainability and resiliency at RSNH?
I'm glad you asked that. I've been here 6 months. So I'm going to continue to refine this vision. But really, there's two parts. There's an internal vision, which is I want every single RSNH associate to be able to talk to their clients in an educated way about the sustainability and resilience vernacular, the language that we use around these things. Our clients are increasingly demanding it, and when they don't ask about it, it is our duty to also follow up and ask them about it. So that's one of my core components to one of the core components to my vision. The second component to that is external, right? To grow our sustainability and resilience market, so to speak, outside of not only serving our existing markets, but to also engage with emerging markets. Those emerging markets may be in energy, they may be in water, they may be in natural resource planning, they may be in air quality. But so those two components are really, look ahead and look ahead again on that H3 timeline into the emerging markets, but also give our RSNH associates now the tools they need to engage in this. You know, we're sitting in one of the most incredible opportunities that's really presented itself in my lifetime and probably yours, right? Increasing regulatory demand, lots of funding, and our market drivers are coming from our clients and our government agencies. So it's really a perfect storm and an opportunity to really make a difference.
The wonderful thing about your vision is it really takes both an internal and an external view. If you just do one of those, you sort of miss the mark. And so right. Is it your notion that if you can go on both of these fronts, an internal, getting our associates, our colleagues, our teammates working on sustainability and resiliency with our clients, we can also go to our clients and give them the tools, the kind of plans to advance their priorities as well.
Right, exactly.
And so when you think about the opportunity that exists in our industry, is it really a situation where there is so much to be done? How do you figure out where to go and what to do?
You know, I think I ask myself that almost every day because it's like whack-a-mole with opportunities right now. And I could write out a 5-page document of bullet points of opportunities that we could go into. What I like to do is really take a step back and focus. What are our key markets at RSNH? Focusing on what we are doing currently in our current markets and then leveraging those to enter new markets. That's really my focus point. And so, for example, we focus in transportation. So I'm looking ahead at market mapping with our investment strategy team in the transportation sector. Where is that going? What's happening in that? And how can our new growth in sustainability and resilience support continued growth in transportation, as well as looking ahead at future technologies, future demands, future regulatory demands as far as resiliency and sustainability in transportation? And it may be more resilience on the transportation side. It comes down to focus, right?
It does. And I think as we think about our focus, we've looked at this both through that internal lens of focus, but also the external lens where we deliver solutions to our clients. I want to get back to something you mentioned a moment ago, and that is kind of the impact that the change in our climate is having, and in fact, the staggering impact of that change and how it affects everyone. You know, resiliency at its core relates to everyone. Have you noticed a rise in resiliency? And secondarily, how is this affecting the architecture engineering industry?
I absolutely have noticed a rise in resiliency. And increasingly, our clients and our markets that may have been initially resistant to the word sustainability or the term sustainability, they're very open and they're seeking resilience solutions and resiliency solutions. And that really allows us to go into markets that, you know, the topic on sustainability may not be open to. Everybody is affected by climate change at this point, and the changing weather, unplanned natural events. It's a very unpredictable environment in terms of our climate. And all of our existing clients and new clients are really interested in resilient solutions, right? We go in with solutions for people. You know, a solution for a client in Reno, Nevada is going to look very different than a client who's in Virginia, for example.
Absolutely. And you think about how this unplanned, unpredictable nature of what we're dealing with, it actually means you have to pre-plan and put in place a very predictable outcome for any event that you may face. And you talked about that could be different in Reno or in California than it is in Virginia or Florida or in the Northeast. And so when you think about how resiliency itself is impacting our industry, what are you seeing out there?
You know, it's interesting that resiliency in the built environment is affecting things as small as the ASHRAE climate zones. ASHRAE is an organization. It's the American Society of Heating and Air Conditioning Engineers. They set up our climate zones that are in our building codes, that our energy code references. So this organization has recently started shifting their climate zones north, which means our energy codes are affected. And it's very interesting when you're looking at building design. There's an aspect there where we have to go over and above our current energy codes and think about what that might mean if those climate zones continue to push north. In other words, things are getting warmer. And it's a really great, it's a really great place to be when you're talking about this with clients, because we come in and we have so much expertise internally to leverage. We have national presence. We work in different climate zones, and we really understand coastal resiliency, for example. And we can apply that for our experience in Florida to the Pacific Northwest or the coast of California. So even though they're different climate zones, some of those challenges are the same. And the pre-planning part is critical. The Reno airport, for example, the sky is clear today. There's no wildfires nearby. Next week, there might be wildfires, and that can impact indoor air quality and, of course, outdoor air quality. So pre-planning for that and, for example, designing a building that has filtration devices in, perhaps a different type of air distribution system. And that type of planning really is the key, right? Stormwater management, again, resilience planning. Planning for the Oakland Airport, for example, perhaps since their runway sits below sea level, they've got a couple of challenges there, right? Not only are they on loose fill and that's subject to liquefaction, which could, when shaken means settlement, they're also subject to seawater rise. So it's a challenging dynamic out there, but I think it's imperative we go in and talk to our clients in a positive, impactful way and talk about solutions. There's a lot of doom and gloom around sustainability and resilience. And, you know, I really want to get away from that. We're not doom and gloom at RSNH. We're driven to care, and we care, and we care about solutions.
And we learn as you describe that as things change in our environment, in the broader environment, those things then have to change in the built environment. So there may be retrofits. If the climate zone is creeping north and it continues to creep north, that changes on how and when you may make modifications to an existing building or look at an existing facility like an airport in terms of addressing critical solutions that actually make their operation doable under a new scenario. And for many, many years, was it the case that we didn't even have that? We didn't have a change in climate zones. And so now we're beginning to see that impact our clients and the work that we do. How do we go about that working with our clients?
You know, my approach to any type of resilience or sustainability solutions is to really go in one-on-one with your client and talk about what's important to them and what are their priorities. What are their budget? You know, everybody has budget restrictions. We prioritize, we brainstorm, and maybe we pick two or three things to pull out. Maybe we're going to do some comparative analytics with energy modeling on the building side. Maybe we're going to go in and look at the 500-year design storm, which really might be happening every 20 years now. So that those things are impactful to our clients, and we want to follow their lead on what is important to them and prioritize so they can accomplish what they need to. And that's really the key. And, you know, as we learn and as we grow, we share these solutions with other clients. So it's an opportunity to continue growing as both an organization and to impact, have positive impact around us as our clients also learn from us. So.
In the critical aspect of determining priorities, many times results in whether or not the entity or the building or the facility has a major impact. And what you called earlier is that pre-planning, getting ahead of the storm, if you will, so that we can put things in place. Is that an approach that you're developing at the firm?
Yes. And it's also in existence now. Our ESR group has been doing resilience planning and sustainability master planning in the infrastructure and aviation world specifically. And they have built a very robust path to planning for sustainability and resilience and meeting different clients' needs in different geographies and with different priorities, different funding sources. So what I hope to do is take that experience and leverage it for different project types, different facilities, different areas that we perhaps aren't in right now. We have a dedicated team of experts and they've been very successful. And now, you know, we need to leverage their experience and their growth. And they've just done a tremendous job on the projects they're working on and the markets they've touched. And they do support almost all of our markets at RSNH. So it's a really tremendously positive path forward for us. So.
And you've just described another essence of RSNH, and that is taking, you know, our solutions and working within the communities where we live. So having those 70 to 80 offices across the country, we can look at lessons learned from projects, carry them to either new or existing clients in a similar area and bring those solutions into the forefront. Are you seeing clients being open to that kind of effort given the severe strains on their budgets and on their priorities?
Absolutely. Yes. You know, various aspects of this, we can do a life cycle cost assessment and life cycle cost analysis where we can look at first cost versus lifetime costs. And our clients are very interested in that. And that math is very important. And if we look at different solutions and we do those life cycle cost analysis, it becomes very clear what we can do and what we can't do within certain budget parameters. So our clients are very, very open to the planning phase and really figuring out what lies ahead.
I want to talk next about this new Office of Environmental Justice and Civil Rights. And so that office now exists. Can you explain its role in resiliency efforts?
Absolutely. This is a very interesting new office. And the Office of Environmental Justice and Civil Rights is aimed at disadvantaged communities who perhaps didn't have the resources or the connections to complete cleanups, so to speak, or to prevent perhaps larger environmental impact assessments, or to prevent the pollution that may happen when large scale, say petrochemicals companies come into the market. There's a place in Louisiana called Cancer Alley, and I'll use that as an example. Its nickname is Cancer Alley, and this is in South Louisiana between Baton Rouge and New Orleans. And there's 200 petrochemical and refineries along the Mississippi River there, and huge spike in cancer and other health issues coming out of that area. And so this new Office of Environmental Justice and Civil Rights takes a look at communities like that. And they've been given over $500 million in grants to help communities clean up the areas around them, contribute to perhaps building better schools or education areas, new libraries, community resources. And so acting as a bridge between, say, the EPA or a Superfund cleanup, these communities may come in and they may get all new electric school buses, for example, or, you know, beyond just the cleanup. So it's a really exciting step, I believe, for our federal government to be taking this very seriously into these communities that really don't have the resources to prevent the contamination that may happen, and or also to mitigate the effect of environmental contaminants.
And this is brand new. It's in the early stages. What do you see as the promise of this office and its mission?
You know, I think the promise and the mission of this office is really exciting in terms of this issue we have with climate anxiety in our youth. You know, there's a real problem with climate anxiety, and our young next generation leaders who are teenagers right now, perhaps preteens, climate anxiety is real. And for these kids to have an office like this of environmental justice and civil rights that can come into their community and demonstrate positive change. And there's ways that those folks can get involved, just like you and I can get involved in our community. And it's a path forward, right? It provides a leverage and a way to have positive impact in your community. And there's funding now to support that. So that's pretty exciting.
And part of the mental health and anxiety that exists comes from the enormous impact that some of these either natural or unplanned, as you noted earlier, disasters occur. And you're not expecting it. You're not expecting to not be able to go outside because there's wildfire smoke, or to be able to take a plane somewhere you can't get through because of some sort of environmental disaster through flooding or earthquakes or a hurricane. And so what role ultimately does a robust sustainability and resiliency plan, master plan, if you will, as well as what role does the agencies that enact these plans and then the citizenry have in terms of making all this possible to relieve some of this anxiety?
You know, I think in the development of any robust resilience planning, resilience workshops and sustainability workshops with all the community members that want to be involved, stakeholder involvement is critical. You know, the agencies and the citizens and even the federal government, if they're funding something in this realm, they all need to come together at the beginning. And we do the resilience workshop or a sustainability workshop. And it's a little bit like a design charrette, but it's on a larger scale. And it will involve infrastructure folks, and it will involve transportation folks. It will involve buildings folks. The AIA Design Excellence Framework also has these defined categories to help, say, if it is a buildings project. And those types of frameworks are very helpful to have. And again, prioritizing, not everything can be done all at once, right? So for the AIA Design Excellence Framework, perhaps three of those are a focus for a new airport terminal. And having that stakeholder involvement can also change which three that project may be focused on.
And so when you're working with clients on these kinds of issues, are they seeing the same thing that you're seeing? And so do they want their stakeholders involved so that whether it be on the planning phase or in the design phase or even in the implementation phase, do you see that stakeholder involvement all throughout?
I do see stakeholder involvement throughout. It's really upfront. I see more on the upfront, on the planning and the design phase. For example, if you're programming, say, an airport terminal, you're going to want to figure out and talk to the facilities team, the building software engineering team, that they, let's say, the staff for food and beverage, the operator who may be operating in that airport environment, as well as the folks who are running the airport, the director and the associate director. And so planning, at the planning phase, getting the community involved in that is also really important, because a second component to this is that building functions are changing, and you may see a community use in an airport. You may see on the air side, you may see a library incorporated into the programming. You may see the airport wanting to, for example, the Salinas Airport has a car show at their airport facility. They use it for community events. And so the stakeholder involvement on the planning side is incredibly important. And then on the implementation side, yeah, it's a little more difficult because it does get more technical, but it is very important to use the community resources, right? Defining solutions in a community where they don't have any subcontractors, for example, that are able to complete those makes no sense. So in the implementation phase, you do have to look in during the planning phase and see, what are the resources available? Can those facility engineers, can they fine tune that very efficient Porsche of a mechanical system that you've done? Or can the infrastructure be repaired by the local subcontractors? Are there materials available locally? If there's not aggregate available locally, then steering away from concrete is a difficult decision, because I don't like to use asphalt on anything, but you know, we can use that as an example.
Well, I think what you're illustrating is there are any number of factors that come into play, but at the very beginning in the planning process, where individuals come in and have a vision and you create that together, what is your experience around the openness of stakeholders to come in and participate in the ultimate solutions? Do you see active participation in communities, and what does that look like?
We do see a lot of active participation in communities. You know, it, of course, it depends on the community. And it also, quite frankly, it depends on the seasons. You know, when there's icy roads and snow, we get a lot less stakeholder involvement. And, you know, it's the same thing in Phoenix. When it's 118 out, you get less community involvement. So carefully thinking through these things, even to pre-plan the planning phase, is also really important. But we do see quite a bit of community involvement. And that can be really challenging sometimes to handle, and just to get everybody's voices out there and heard and then incorporate it into something real. It can be really challenging, but it's very satisfying when it works out, and it always works out eventually.
And that's the key, right? It's getting to the solutions that actually move the needle to a better place for the community, for our clients, for the citizens that live there. That's really the key of your role is at RSNH, is to drive that kind of success and those solutions into our communities. I'm fascinated at how complicated this is, but also fascinated with your willingness to go down all of these different pathways to develop solutions that make a difference in communities and with our clients. Is that one of the most rewarding parts of, because it sounds like you're really excited about when you can get to those wonderful solutions and prioritize work and then head into that work. Is that something that you get up in the morning to do?
It's very satisfying. And, you know, even on small scales, you know, it's very satisfying work. And I do, you know, I get up in the morning and I am very passionate about what I do. And I feel great typically at the end of the day. If I've moved the needle forward, even a quarter of an inch, it's very satisfying. And when you see large scale impact on a community, for example, here in Scottsdale, I helped pass the International Green Construction Code as mandatory code for all new commercial projects. I was part of the planning phase and part of the community community education. I had one-on-one sessions with city council members and a one-on-one session with the mayor. And it, at the end of the day, when city council adopted this building code and it mandates now these sustainable solutions for all new commercial products, it was incredible. And the impact on the communities is huge.
It's really game changing in that respect.
Yes. Yes. And that's a big picture game changer that was very satisfying. But even on the small scale, if you complete an energy model, say early in the design process, and you see those design iterations investigating different efficiencies and different envelopes and different building orientations, at the end of the day, when the final occupancy CFO is issued, it's pretty satisfying to see some of those things implemented. If the initiatives were not implemented, you know why. We saw them, we understood them, we modeled them, and we went down the road and investigated them. And so, yeah, it's a pretty cool place to be.
I wanna switch and get to some rapid fire questions that we do on our podcast that sort of dive into some of your views on important things. And, you know, we talked a minute ago about mental health and anxiety in from a climate standpoint and what we're seeing in our younger people. What is one thing that you do to support your mental health and wellness?
You know, one of the things for me that is a must is I have to move. I have to move my body. I have to exercise. And I also need sunlight. And being outside and being in the mountains or at the beach, wherever it is, those things really restore me. I call it, nature washing. You go out, you walk in the trees, and that just really restores me. And I think part of that is that it really grounds me back away from the big picture, right? Away from this feeling of climate change is such a huge, complex, multifaceted challenge for our generation. Coming back to earth and being grounded and focusing on the things we can each do at home is really important. So anything that grounds me, I really love being around animals, horses and dogs in particular, and being in the present moment with animals is also another way to stay really grounded for me. So
that is a great tip. And I know we've had all kinds of different perspectives on mental health and wellness, and taking ownership of that as you have makes all the difference in the world. You know, I talked earlier in the podcast about this essence that we have at RSNH around this notion of driven to care. And we are driven to care. It's embedded in the enterprise. It's embedded in our associates. It's what we take to our clients. When you hear the phrase driven to care, what do you think of?
I think of coming into any meeting or addressing any problem or facing any challenge. I think about coming into things with compassion and empathy and really trying to build bridges with, you know, whether it's your client you're talking with, whether it's a community member in a community meeting whose views you may oppose, you know, just thinking and through problems with a heavy dose of compassion and empathy for everybody involved, including our own teams, right? That's really part of driven to care, I think, is talking with people and looking at them as human beings.
There's nothing like a little compassion and empathy, or in many times, a lot of compassion and empathy, especially with the issues that you deal with on a day-to-day basis, literally life and death in some cases, or the preventing loss of life, or preventing that loss of property. I appreciate that perspective and bringing that to the table from your perspective is driven to care. And I really appreciate you explaining that to our listeners. My third rapid fire question is, has a movie, book, podcast, not this one, we won't self-promote this one, or TV show had a major impact on you? And if so, what was it?
Well, I have two. So I'll talk really quick about a movie I saw when I was a kid And it was about nuclear war. And talk about a horrible subject for a kid, right? I remember the family, they went underground, they had to leave their golden retriever up above ground, they went into their fallout shelter. And that just stuck with me for some reason. That has been an impact even now. I'm 48 years old and I still think about watching that movie. First, I think about why my parents even let me see that movie. But, you know, it was impactful. And I think it drove me into the industry and the field and the specialization that I'm in. And the second one, on a more positive note, is the Ezra Klein podcast, The Best Decarbonization. The Best Decarbonization podcast I've ever heard is an Ezra Klein podcast. He is a podcast generator for the New York Times, and he has some of the best podcasts for explaining complex, challenging subjects. And his decarbonization podcast really opened my eyes to the concept of decarbonizing our built environment, including infrastructure and roads and bridges. It's going to be a multifaceted approach. There is no one solution. We can't just put PV across the middle part of the United States, right? Photovoltaics only go a little bit of a ways. And it's a very interesting approach because he talks about carbon sequestering and decarbonizing our energy sector and renewable energy. And it's going to come to a huge mix of all these things and new technologies that are emerging. So it's a very upbeat podcast, and I highly recommend it to everybody, of course, after this podcast. But
absolutely, and multifaceted is what you've been able to deliver for us today. So I think you're sort of batting up there with Ezra on that. And I'll tell you, your expertise here at RSNH, what you've been able to do in such a short period of time to take our ship and guide it in the right direction so that we can deliver great solutions for our clients, so that we can think about those priorities and help them with their solutions that are unique all across our great country. And I really appreciate you being a part of this podcast and bringing your expertise and talking about sustainability and resiliency in a way that everyone can understand. So I'm so pleased to have Linnea Brudenell, the RSNH National Sustainability and Resiliency Director, with us today on the AEC Perspectives podcast. Thank you, Linnea.
Thank you so much for having me. And it's an amazing team we have here at RSNH. I'm really pleased to be a part of it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of AEC Perspectives. Follow or subscribe to AEC Perspectives wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. And remember, at RSNH, we are driven to care.